Hello, and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we depart from our regular program to bring you a Juneteenth special. The segments in today's episode are all produced by our roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, and were originally broadcast in 2019. We begin with the question, what is Juneteenth? Then Willie Terry takes us to the 2019 Juneteenth celebration of the Capital Region in Central Park in Schenectady and speaks with vendors. In today's program, Willie Terry interviews Rachel Kahn, Executive Director of the Hamilton Hill Arts Center, the center that co-sponsored the event, Kareem Tour, poet and author of books Mahogany Scriptures and Chocolate Clouds, Beverly Bardaquez, president of Rap Road Historical District, about the history of the Rap Road African American community in Albany, and Jacqueline Kane, author of A Real Whole Lot, a World War II soldier's love letters to his wife. We begin with Willie Terry's overview of the meaning of Juneteenth and why we celebrate.
Your Roman labor reporter, Willie Terry. In this segment today, I'm going to talk a little bit about Juneteenth, celebrated on June the 19th. A lot of people don't know about Juneteenth, so I'm going to talk about it for a second. On June the 19th, 1865, Major General Gorton Granger, he came to Galveston, Texas to inform a reluctant community that President Abraham Lincoln, 2 years earlier, had freed the slaves. And he was there to press the local community there to follow that directive that was put out by Abraham Lincoln. There was no reason why there was a 2.5-year delay in letting Texas know about the abolition of slavery in the United States. In Texas, there was about 250,000 slaves. So that means that, you know, for 2.5 years, they were continuously enslaved, even though the country had abolished slavery. Henry Louis Gates Jr., professor from Harvard University, he said that many of the slave owners, after the fall of New Orleans, traveled to Texas with their slaves to escape regulations to enforce the abolition of slavery. And he said the U.S. government put the slave owner in charge of letting the slaves know about the news. And some of them delayed relaying that information until after, he said, the harvest. So they wanted to get them to work the field 2 more years. Now, there was an article put out by Stacy Conrad. In that article, and it's a good article, and you should Google it and read it about Juneteenth. It's called 12 Things You Might Not Know About Juneteenth. She started off by saying that there was a more than one independent day in the U.S. And she's correct, because we know about 1776, you know, and that's the day that we're going to celebrate soon, the 4th of July. But Frederick Douglass gave a speech back in the 1800s on the 4th of July saying, what is the 4th of July to the slave? Because we were still in bondage after their freedom. But on June the 19th, 1865, when the U.S. General Gorton Granger rode into Galveston, Texas and announced to the slaves that they were free, maybe that is the day that we should celebrate. Now, since then, June the 19th has been celebrated as a Juneteenth. And Juneteenth is a mixture of June and the 19th. So it's Juneteenth. Now, in her 12 things you might not know about Juneteenth, I'm going to just mention a few. And like I said, I would advise you to go and Google this article and read it. One of the things she said is that slaves had already been emancipated. They just didn't know. The June 19 announcement came more than 2.5 years after Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which was on January 1st, 1863. And she said that there was 250,000 slaves in Texas. They were already free, but none of them were aware of it. And no one was in a rush to tell them. The second point she brought out is there are many theories as to why the law wasn't enforced in Texas. And she laid out 5 points. And the first point was that news traveled slowly back in those days. That was the point. And the second point was that Texas slave owners purposely suppressed the announcement. And the third point was that the original messenger who was supposed to deliver this announcement was murdered to prevent the information from being relayed. And the fourth point she made is that the federal government purposely delayed the announcement to Texas in order to get more cotton harvest out of the slaves, as the government worked with the slave owners. And the fifth point she raised is that the real reason is probably that Lincoln Proclamation simply wasn't enforceable in the rebel states before the end of the war. 2.5 years more of slavery, even though it was abolished 2.5 years ago. Now, the third point she made is that the announcement actually urged free slaves to stay with their former owners. Can you imagine? You stand with somebody who brutalizes you, oppress you, enslave you, and you have to stay with them and work for them. So where's the freedom? What about reparation? And in that announcement, what it said was, and this is the government, it said that even though they were free, they were informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts, and that they will not be supported in idleness, either there or elsewhere. What about reparation? But she also made the point that before Granger, the general, could finish making that announcement, slaves were already leaving. I mean, there was already protests and fighting by the slaves against slavery. And they were leaving Texas. And after that announcement, she made in her 4 points, what she called what followed was known as scatter. When the slaves heard that announcement, they left in droves from that former slave state. They got out of there. They were ready to roll. I'm going to go over the other points, but just to let you know that Texas was the first state to declare Juneteenth a state holiday. And since then, there were many other states that declared Juneteenth a state holiday. But Juneteenth is still not a federal holiday. And why not? And they gave Martin Luther King a federal holiday, which is commendable, and everybody wanted it. But Juneteenth is the day that we should celebrate, because that was the day that the last Africans knew of their freedom, and that was the day of freedom called Juneteenth. Juneteenth is celebrated throughout the country in many cities and states. On Saturday, June 15th, I attended the Hamilton Hill Arts Center 19th annual celebration of Juneteenth in the Capital District, and this was in Schenectady at Central Park. And the celebration actually started June the 14th, with a march to the Vale Cemetery to pay homage to the African ancestral burial ground. While attending this Juneteenth celebration by the Hamilton Hills Art Center in the Central Park, there was a lot of activities. There was activities of Black Author Expo, Women Empowerment Workshops, and there was activities for the kids, and music, and community building workshops, and head wrapping workshop. And there was also a Father of the Year presentation. And they had a music band, George Boone Blue Music. And that was the celebration that was going on in the Capital Region. Like I said, there are celebrations throughout the country about Juneteenth. Yeah, this is Willie Terry, a Roman labor correspondent here in Schenectady at the Juneteenth celebration in Central Park. And I have as my guest the executive director for the Hamilton Hill Art Center, Rachel Kahn, who is going to tell us something about this day. How you doing, Rachel?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Rachel, this is Juneteenth. You know, every year they celebrate Juneteenth all over the world. Well, at least in America, they celebrate it. Tell us something about Juneteenth.
Well, it's the oldest known celebration of the freedom from slavery. And it's just so important that we come together to celebrate how far we've come and to remind ourselves of how far we still have to go.
All right. Now, Rachel, you're the executive director of the Hamilton Hill Art Center. Tell us something about you and the Hamilton Hill Art Center.
Well, at the Hamilton Hill Art Center, we promote the arts and culture of the African diaspora. And we do that in order to, celebrate the gifts that we've been given from our ancestors and to restore our community to a sense of wholeness.
So, Rachel, how did you get involved in this process?
Well, my grandmother founded the Art Center, and I've been there since I was an infant. Grew up under her desk, watching her do, her job, and I just, have come to love it. I came back to the Art Center when I was a mother and wanted to figure out how to make Schenectady the kind of place that I wanted to live in. So I came back because I saw the Art Center as a vehicle to make the world a better place.
Now, you're a resident of Schenectady, right?
I am, yes.
And but tell me something about your life. Who is Rachel Kahn?
Like I said, I did grow up in the Art Center, which made me an artist. So I do arts of all different forms. I'm a painter and a sculptor and a potter. I also write poetry, and I have my degree in Afrocentric psychology.
From where?
From Empire State College.
Oh, okay. And do you have kids?
I do. I have a daughter. She's grown now. So that tells how long I've been working at the center in one way or another.
Oh, okay. Now, I know it takes a lot of effort to put on an event like this right here. So what were some of the activities that happened today?
Okay. Well, first I want to say that we couldn't have done it without our fabulous Juneteenth committee. We have a lot of people that work hard to put this on. And we have some great events. We have Ill Funk. We have the George Boone Village Band. We have our hip-hop team, the Young Leaders, was on today, and our Emoja Dancers were there. We also have an author's expo, where some young black authors, some who are self-published and some who have been published by others, have come together to talk about their work. We have a women's empowerment workshop, a head wrapping workshop, and a capoeira workshop going on over at the pavilion. And lots of great vendors.
Ooh.
Yeah, lots of good food and African artifacts and people to tell you about, organizations that you can use in Schenectady.
Oh, okay. And people can't see you like I can see you. You got a head wrap of an African garment. Can you tell me something about that?
Well, this is just, I guess, my style. As I said, I grew up in the Art Center. My family lived in Kenya for 4 years, and so it's heavily influenced my, the way that I live in the world.
But I went to Ghana, and, oh, yeah. And it looked like something like kente cloth. It reminds me of.
Yeah, no, this isn't kente. It's just a pattern that I liked.
Uh-huh. And how many days is this event will go on?
Well, it's a two-day event. It started yesterday at Vale Cemetery in the African-American section. We start off our events there because we go to honor our ancestors. And then the next day is the, you know, Saturday in the park where we celebrate and have fun. But you know, at the Art Center, we have programs going on every day. We're there 7 days a week with our hip-hop, capoeira, and African dance classes, our after-school programs. So we have a lot going on.
Juneteenth, is it a day that is connected to government celebrate this? Did they issue a proclamation or anything?
Yes. We have two proclamations, one issued by the mayor and one by the county to make Juneteenth official. And now, to thank the Art Center for all the work we do to put it on. This is our 19th year.
The 19th?
Yep.
Now, what kind of activities did they have for kids?
We have pony rides, face painting, we have a book sale. The whole event is fun for the whole family.
So what's the music? You have two separate places?
No, we on our main stage we have the music with Ill
Funk. You have a main stage, yeah. I was trying to see, yeah, over here.
And the pavilion is where we have our workshops.
Oh, okay. So this is the stage where the bands and different things are, and here just the workshops and the hair.
Right.
How did those events go?
They're going fabulous. Everybody seems to be having a really good time.
Yeah. What would you say the estimate of the crowd that came here today?
I'm not too good with numbers. It's hard to tell. We usually estimate that there's about 1,000 or 2,000 people at these events. So.
So people be looking forward to this every year, the 19 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I want to say that it was a good event today, you know, here.
Yeah.
And I talked to some of the artists, the authors. And what did you find all those black authors at?
Well, you know, part of the wonderful thing about working at the Art Center is that there are so many different artists that connect with us and work with us with
and
our programs.
They're from Schenectady.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
We'd like to keep a good list of artists around, you know, so that we can, you know, promote their work and send them out to schools and businesses so that they can enjoy them as well.
So what would you tell people who haven't experienced this? What would you say to them?
Just that it's a good time, that nothing more worth celebrating than your freedom, and I invite you to come out. We'll be here next year again.
Okay. All right. That's Rachel Khan, Executive Director of the Hamilton Hill Arts Center here at Juneteenth. And thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm here at the Hamilton Hill Juneteenth celebration in Schenectady Central Park. And there's a lot of authors out here. And I'm lucky to get interview with one of the authors by the name of Kareem Robinson, right? How you doing, Kareem?
Good, good. Thank you.
Kareem, I see you got a book here called Mohagany Scripture. Is that the only book you wrote?
No, it isn't. I've also released a book entitled Chocolate Clouds, which was just released this year.
Okay. And that's the other book on your table.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yep. Kareem, tell me something about yourself.
Well, I was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut. I was raised in the borough of Brooklyn, East New York, to be specific. I'm a descendant of African descent. My father, obviously, on the African side. My mother from Santa Isabella, Puerto Rico. I'm an independent poet, independent author. I just love to share my work and get out to people who can relate. And I cover several topics such as depression, social justice, food justice, also my love for black women and us being a spiritual people as far as African people goes.
So how did you get into writing, though?
I guess it was something that was inherited. My father, back in the day, in his time, as he would say, was a DJ. He was also a rapper, a hip-hop artist, I should say. So I guess it was kind of inherited. It just took for me to come to an experience to bring that out of me, that inner Arthur in myself, that innovative creator that was within me all that time. I just had to go through an experience or come across something in general to bring that out of me.
Yeah, I know you're a cultural person, and your name is Kareem Robinson, but I've seen something say Kareem Ture.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you brought that up. So when I wrote my first book, Mahogany Scriptures, I was filling out the application form through Amazon, and I tried to put in my poet name, which is Kareem Ture. Kareem being my first name, Ture, I got it inspired by the Pan-Africanist Kwame Ture. So I took that last title because he's inspired me with his work. And but by the time I was able to change the last name, it was already submitted. Amazon already approved it. So I just made a correction in my second book. I made sure I got it out that my poet name is Kareem Ture.
All right. So you was around when... you remember Kwame Ture?
I've studied some of his work, yes.
Did you ever meet him or see him?
No, unfortunately not. I was born in 93, and I'm pretty sure by that time he already had transitioned to the ancestors.
Oh, okay. Well, you mean you're talking to somebody who did see him, meet with him, talk to him, everything. I know he died.
Yes.
Very revolutionary, but always talked about organizing, right?
Yes, absolutely. Organization, not just mobilization.
That's right. Now, Kareem, before I talk to you about the chocolate... clouds, tell me something about the Mahogany Scripture.
Yes,
the
Mahogany Scriptures was actually inspired by one of my favorite neo-soul singers, Maxwell, who was also born in Brooklyn, East New York. At the time, I was going through a heartbreak with my former female partner. So at the time, I was down in the dumps. And his album titled Urban Hang Suite inspired me, and it got me through it, and it inspired me to write. So I wrote about my hardship going through heartbreak, as well as people that I met, different women that shared their stories of me of depression and also contemplating suicide. And I also wrote things that my younger brother was going through. And I also wrote about the social injustice that was going on and within our communities, and that all those things kind of culminated and were the genesis and the foundation of me writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the scripture part of it?
Scripture is just pretty much... to me, the way I interpret that is just collective writing of collective work for people to read through. I got the concept pretty much from one of the books I've studied, the Bible, and you know that's scripture too. People take whatever it is they may, and they interpret it, and hopefully they utilize it in a positive way, whatever they get from my work.
Now, this was your first book?
My first book.
Right, and what was the process like? Trying to. Put out this first book?
It was very time consuming. I obviously had to follow the law of risk and reward. I had to risk not doing certain things I was used to doing in order to get the ultimate reward, which is to put this book out, turn it into a reality, because it all started with an idea. So it was very time consuming. It was very sacrificial as far as things I had to sacrifice, but ultimately I got it done, and a lot of people were in my corner to help me.
Okay. Now, let me ask you about the second book you said just came out.
Yes.
Chocolate Cloud. Now, what's that book about?
Yes, that book is more personable. For me, I reveal my OCD. I reveal a time where I was going through depression. Also, it reveals a time where I've seen my fiance go through a tough time while watching one of her favorite people, her aunt, die, you know, transition. And it's just a lot more personable. And obviously I touch on black male depression with myself, depression in general, being in love. I've dedicated a poem, I believe several poems, to my fiance, and me honoring my mother. And yeah, that's pretty much it. It's more personable in comparison to Mahogany Scriptures, where it was more other people's story than mine.
So what audience, or what are you trying to say to people in writing this book?
Pretty much practice with your poetry. That's one of my sayings that I have on my wristband that I created, and that applies to anything you do in life. You know, don't just sit there and talk about what you're going to do. Actually do it, because people respect you more when you stand in your word through action. So that's pretty much the message that I'm trying to get, and be unapologetic about anything that you do that you love, just as long as it's constructive and positive.
Now, today is Juneteenth, and you know this is like a special day. So what are your what do you think about the Juneteenth day?
I think it's very, very pivotal, and it's imperative that we honor our ancestors. We stand on the shoulders of giants that paved the way for us, and it's very important, especially in this time where we have an administration that obviously doesn't care about us at all. But yet again, we shouldn't rely on them to care about us or do things for us. We should do things for ourselves. That's one thing that the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey preached. It's race first, do for self, and not be dependent on others. Because when you do that, you subject yourself to a slave.
Okay. So, Kareem, I just want to ask you a couple more questions. Now, if someone wants to get copies of your book, where could they get copies of your book?
Yes, you could get it on Amazon.com. Type in my name, Kareem Teray, or Kareem Robertson. Or you could go to my website, 33193poetryav.com.
So they could get in touch with you at that site, like if they want you to come by and talk about your book?
Absolutely. You could contact me on my website. Just send an email, and I'll respond immediately.
Okay. All right. That is Kareem Robinson. Thank you. And he has two books out called Mohogany Scripture and Chocolate Clouds. So you can get that on Amazon.com and at the website that he gave you. Yes. Thank you, Kareem.
All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
This is Willie Terry at the Schenectady Juneteenth here in Washington Park. I'm at a table called the Rap Road Historical District. And I have as my guest
Beverly Bardaquez from Rap Road.
Okay, Beverly, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
All right. And Beverly, tell me something about your position in the Rap Road Historical Society.
Well, we are a nonprofit organization, the Rap Road Historical Association. I preside as president currently, and it's a nonprofit organization that was started back in, we actually started the nonprofit in 2015, but we started researching and recording our history back in the late 1990s. My aunt Emma Dixon, Emma Woodard Dixon, and another young lady by the name of Jennifer Lamack started researching the history of the residents of the Rap Road community. They want Emma, who was born into the community, wanted to know the history of how they got started there, because there were all kinds of rumors of how this African-American community evolved there. Some said they were put there by the mayor of Albany at the time, who was Mayor Corning, to work on the pig farms out there. Not true. There were all kinds of rumors of how they got there and settled there, because they were a farming community. And we got there through the pastor of our church. The pastor's name was Lewis W. Parson. He was a traveling minister from the South. He was from Mississippi. He was from Buckatuna, Mississippi, but he was a young traveling minister, and he wanted to head north because of oppression in the South. And he came to Cleveland, Ohio first, and he didn't feel Cleveland was a good fit for him and his wife, Frances. So he said, come on, Frances, let's head east. And they ended up in Albany, New York, in the South End. There was a revival going on down at Union Missionary Baptist Church, which still exists today. This is back in the the late 20s, early 30s. And he met up with three women who had formed a prayer group. And he and those three women eventually established a church. He wanted to grow his church, so he started going back south to Mississippi to recruit family members and friends to come and be part of his church. That's how the people started coming to Albany from Shibuda, Mississippi. They were from Hattiesburg, Meridian, Mobile, Alabama. Some came from Savannah, Georgia. Some came from Florida. And they joined this church, which was called the First Church of God in Christ in Albany. Today, that church is known as Wilburn Temple, which celebrated its 95th anniversary recently. And they wanted to, some of the residents, when they came to Albany South End, wanted to go back to Mississippi and where they came from, because they did not like the living conditions here. It was foreign to them. They were farmers and sharecroppers. Where they were living was, you know, very different than where they had come from. And an effort to keep them there, Lewis and another young man by the name of William Tolliver purchased some land in the western part of Albany, known as the Pine Bush Barrens. And they first purchased 14 acres of land. And they started parceling out the land to parishioners of the church. They would only sell to parishioners of the church. They started parceling off parcels of land to the parishioners. They then, Lewis and his wife, 3 years later, that was in March of 1930. 3 years later, they purchased another, Lewis and his wife purchased another 14 acres of land.
That is the minister?
This is the minister. And 1940, Lewis passed away. But his wife continued to sell parcels of land to parishioners. Some would come and purchase land, and then they would leave and sell to other people. At the height of the community in the 1930s, there were 23 families that resided in the community. They started out by clearing the land, making gardens, growing all kinds of cornfields, greens, peas, tomatoes, cucumbers, all kinds of things they grew in those gardens. They made their own irrigation system because there was no water, so they had to figure out how to irrigate these crops that they were growing. It was sand out there. It was all sand. Where they had come from, it was clay. So, but they were very industrious people, and they knew how to do things. The church was the glue that held them together. The church and family members that had come here and got established would embrace people coming to town for the first time until they could get on their feet. And there was no welfare. They didn't rely on welfare. It was between the church and family that they were able to survive until they could get established, as I said.
So what happened to Rep?
Okay, we eventually were able, this was during the Great Migration now, so there was a lot of oppression in the South, so they really didn't, many of them really didn't desire to go back to South because of the lynchings and the lack of practical education for their children. They wanted a better way of life for their children. So they stayed in this community and they started building little modest bungalows by hand. They dug their foundations by hand, laid the foundations, and as they could afford to purchase materials, they bought materials or they used repurposed materials where buildings had been torn down, and they would go and get the usable material and bring it home in their cars or however they could get it there. That was 96 years ago. And today there are second, third, fourth, and fifth generation still living in the Rap Road community. Right now, there are about 12 homes that remain.
Do the African Americans that own the land?
Some of us still own our original homes and properties. Okay, the others have moved into the community, but there are those of us that still own the original homes and the land that went with those homes. I happen to live next door to the homestead where my grandparents settled in the 1940s. My grandparents moved to Rap Road in 1942, somewhere around there.
They're from Mississippi?
I am not from Mississippi. My grandparents were from Mississippi. My grandmother and two of her brothers and some of her cousins bought land in the Rap Road community, and they were first generation there. Their children moved away. Some of them came back to the community.
When the people moved up here, did they experience some racism and problems, or were they kind of accepted?
It was a lot different for them up here than it was down south. For example, my mother was about 12 years old when they moved up here, and she was amazed that all the children went to the same school. There was, you know, it was an integrated school educational system. And down south, they couldn't do that. Down south, the black children had to walk past the whites children's school to get to their school, which paled in comparison because they didn't have the resources that the children at the white school. My mom said they used to have to walk 7 miles one way to get to school, and they had to walk 7 miles to come back home. But you know, this is the way life was in the South, and there were a lot of differences. The homes, she was not used to homes being connected. Down in the south end of Albany, they had row houses. That was foreign to her because where they lived, it was farmland. You didn't have, you know, connected houses. And so there was, but the sense I got from her was there were not a lot of obvious racism. She said, you know, some of her friends were, you know, white, and that she grew up with. Down in the south end on Herkimer Street, Duncan Avenue, where they lived, Green Street, Ferry Street, all those streets in this, what's known as the pastures now, they had a lot of people that were from the Jewish community, they were from the Italian community, they were from the Polish community. So you had a blend of people living down there at the time.
Now, did they have black businesses in the Rap community?
In Rap Road community, they didn't have businesses in the community, but the church was very, very instrumental in terms of helping them get established. For example, where we live in the Rap Road community, the Albany School District would not provide bus transportation for the children, because at that point in time, Rap Road was a tiny little, what, you could barely get one car down the road. It was a little lane, and the school bus couldn't get in and out. So the children either had to be driven to school, or they had to walk out to the end of Rap Road to Western Avenue to get transferred to school. The church decided to purchase a school bus so that they could get their children to and from school. My uncle, who was a very industrious man, he would have equipment where they could widen the road, and he and some of the other men in the community widened the road at one point so the school bus could turn around. And now they have a school bus, they have a way to get the school bus in and out. They needed a driver. My grandmother, who was a very, I called her a Renaissance woman, she offered to drive the school bus. So I like to think of her as the first black woman, female bus driver. And she drove that school bus for the children for a good while. And so we have a very rich history in the Pine Bush community. And we've had a lot of issues with encroachment because we have had to fight off developers wanting to come in and take and build, you know, and we're not commercially zoned.
We call it gentrification.
Gentrification. And we are trying to stave them off. And that's why we formed ourselves as a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, that was the question I wanted to ask you. What were the goals and objectives of the railroad historic?
To preserve and restore our community. In 2002, we were nominated and placed on the New York State Historic Register. In 2003, we were placed on the National Historic Register.
Do y'all have a conference or something every year?
We do an annual fundraiser once a year. We just did our fundraiser May 10th of this year. And it was very successful. Our goal is to branch out and start doing conferences so that we can invite other organizations and invite people in the community to come and learn about African American history in this area.
You should have a college course about this.
Well, we're working very closely with a lot of the colleges. For example, we work with SUNY at Albany. We've worked very closely with RPI. We've worked with Skidmore College. There's several colleges that have expressed an interest in working with us. And our goal is to go into the school districts so that we can share our history with the children.
Okay. Just one last question I want to ask you. How could one get in touch with you if they want to historical side?
I'll
have you to come and talk to them.
Well, you can call me, Beverly Bartiquez, at 518-605-4854. And we'll be happy to take you on a tour. We'd be happy to come and share our history with you and let you see where we are and what we are about.
All right. That's Beverly Bartiquez, who's president of the Rap Roll Historic Society. And I want to say that you're a history book.
I'm a history book?
Yeah, I didn't expect to get this much information. You know, hey, you got to write. And there is a book on the table now.
Yes, there is.
Now, who did the book?
This book was...
I'm sorry, I'll get it up. Southern Life, Northern City.
Yes. The book was a result of research that was done by my aunt Emma Woodard Dixon and a young SUNY grad student, Jennifer Lamack. They were the ones that spearheaded gathering the history and recording it. And as a result of that, the book was written by Jennifer.
Well, I want to say that is book one, because it got to be a book two.
We're hoping to do, we do have a short documentary that was done a couple of summers ago, and we're working on a second one. And if life lasts me and God wills, I hope to write the second part of our history.
Right. Thank you. Good luck on that.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, my grandpa used to say, the luck is in the Lord and the conduct in the people.
I hear you. Thank you, Beverly.
Thank you very much.
Yo, this is Willie Terry, still here at the Juneteenth celebration in Central Park in Schenectady. And I'm here at one of the author tables that says a real whole lot. She wrote a book called A Real Whole Lot, and her name is Jacqueline A. Kane. And it's a memoir, a World War II soldier love letter to his wife. And how you doing, Jacqueline?
I'm fine. How are you today, Willie?
All right. And Jacqueline, tell me something about yourself and how you got into writing.
Okay, well, let's see, I was born in New York City. I grew up in the Bronx, and I moved here to Albany in 1975 to work. And I've always written, I guess you would call people's journalism, where there are things where I've shared my thoughts and feelings about different things. So I think of myself as a nonfiction writer. And after my parents died, my siblings and I were going through their papers, and we found these love letters. And so I decided, with a little encouragement from family and friends, to publish these letters. And that's what this book is, A Real Whole Lot, is those letters.
And these are the letters between your mother and your father.
Right.
And what were your mother and father's name?
My mother was also Jacqueline, and my father's name was Philip. But they referred to each other in their letters as Jack and Phil.
Okay. And where were they from?
They were from Baltimore. They grew up in Baltimore. They moved to New York City. Well, actually, my mother moved to New York City in 1945 to go to graduate school. And after my father got out of the service, he joined my mother, and they remained in New York City. So that's why I grew up in the Bronx.
Now, did they migrate here? Their parents migrate here from here?
Well, my grandparents were from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and they had migrated to Baltimore. And then my parents migrated to New York City.
Okay. All right. And now you wrote this book, The Real Whole Lot. So tell us something about the book.
Okay, well, this is a collection of love letters and diary excerpts, which take place between 1943 and 1945. Most of the letters are letters from my father, because my mother was able to keep a lot of his letters, whereas at some point my father had to throw away some of her letters because he couldn't carry them any longer. So there's a letter in the book where he tells my mother that he's throwing away 500 of her letters because he can't carry them anymore. And I think that was about the time he was going from North Africa to Marseille, where he was last stationed.
They wrote 500?
Yes, that he threw away. Because they wrote to each other every day. And sometimes my father would write to my mother three or four times a day, depending on, you know, what was going on, whether he had time or just inclined to be in touch with my mother every day.
Now, what war was it?
This was World War II. My father was stationed overseas in North Africa and in southern France.
Now, why did you name the book A Real Whole Lot?
Well, my father, at the end of every all of his letters, he would write some variation of that phrase, like, I love you a real whole lot, or something about a real whole lot. And it just seemed that because he used that sign-off consistently in almost all of his letters, that it would be an appropriate title for the book.
Yeah. So when he came back from World War, right, Have he had kids before he went?
No. One of the things that's interesting about my parents' story is that my father graduated from Morgan State University in June of 1941. They got married a couple of days after he graduated. He then was drafted in October of 41. So they actually only lived together a couple of months before my father was drafted into the military. I'm the oldest, and I wasn't born until 1946 after my father got out of the service. So they didn't have any children before he went into the military.
And how long were they together?
When my father died, they had been married for 66 years.
66 years?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yes. So part of this book is about the beginning of their marriage and their romance together. And, you know, since they really hadn't been able to spend that much time with each other before they got, you know, before he went overseas, it is about them, you know, expressing their longing for each other.
Now, what were some of the special things about his the writing, the love letter? Tell me something, you know. Words they used.
No, well, one of the things that I think is interesting is, first of all, you know, the sign off, A Real Whole Lot. That was something unique. And they also, my father came up with all kinds of nicknames like Sugar Dumpling, Sweetie Pie, Honey, Darling. I mean, you know, there were just any number of ways in which he tried to entitle the letters, showing that he was thinking about her in different kinds of ways. So that was another kind of unique thing, I think, about the letters.
Now, how did you publish the letters in the book? Did you have to, scratch some stuff out, or
no? I pretty much
as is.
Right. I worked with someone to transcribe the letters because they write cursive writing, and because I knew their handwriting, I could read it, but not everybody could read the handwriting. So I had the letters transcribed. There are two copies of letters in the book, one from my father and one from my mother, just so that people could see what the letters look like. So I had them transcribed, and I was pretty faithful to what they wrote. I mean, even down to spellings, like my father would spell all right, A-L-R-I-T-E. But the way we spell it now would be A-L-R-I-G-H-T. So I left things like that because that was the way in which they communicated at that time, and I didn't really want to change anything. I wanted people to get a feeling for how they communicated with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, 60 years, that's a long time.
Yes.
Now, how did your brothers and sisters take it?
Actually, they were encouraging me. I don't think either one of them had read all the letters, but we knew about the letters. We didn't know how many of them my parents still had, because there's a story about how my mother got teased about the letters at one point. So we knew the letters existed, but we didn't know that that these many of them had survived.
Now, I just want to ask this question. I mean, it's not like a lot of times people, you know, write books and especially love stories, and they make these love stories into plays or movies. Do you think that the love story that they wrote is something that maybe at some point it could be put into a
I think it could be. As a matter of fact, I was talking with another author who really is encouraging me to fictionalize take the letters and make a romance novel out of it. So my sister had said to me at one point, well, if I was going to write a real fictional story, I'd have to talk about all of the things in my parents' relationship. And I said, well, I would just write about the early days of their marriages, not all of the, you know, all the trials and tribulations that they went through in 66 years. So, but I do think it could be a good love story. I really do.
This is about the only book you're going to have off those letters?
Well, probably from the letters. I mean, I'm thinking about fictionalizing. That's one thing. The other thing is that I also found letters that my mother kept that I wrote to my family when I was a freshman in college. So I'm thinking about publishing those letters also, because it would tell a story about, going to college, going to a historically black institution, because I also went to Morgan State University, and what my experience was my freshman year.
Now, one of the things that would happen to black soldiers when they was overseas, there was a lot of racism. And I wonder, did he you know, write her and tell her about some of the issues and things that they had?
Not in the letters that survived. There are only two references that he makes to race. One is a letter early on when my mother is going to visit him in Virginia, and he's giving her directions about how to navigate the train in terms of how she would have to change trains in D.C. because that was the point at which black folks could not ride in the front of the train. They had to ride in the colored only. He was giving her directions about where to find the colored waiting area, where to find the colored cabs, that kind of thing. And then later on, there's a reference that he makes where he's saying that the captain came in and said, "Are you ready to go home?" And my father said, "Yes." And the captain said, "Well, report tomorrow." And my father gets to the ship, and he's not allowed to get on. So what he says is, in the letter, is, "I forgot to paint myself white." So it meant that for that particular ship, they were only taking white soldiers home. They weren't taking any black soldiers home. So those are the only times in those letters that he makes any reference to race and he think about his experience. There are a couple of newspaper clippings that I've included in the book that talks a little bit about the experiences of Negro soldiers, and my father's referenced in those two articles.
All right. But now, today is Juneteenth. What are your thoughts on this day?
Oh, wow. Well, it's historical. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about the Emancipation Proclamation and then what happened in terms of people getting the information in Texas in particular, where people had migrated to Texas with slaves, so that even though I guess technically Texas was not a slave state, there were enslaved people there. And so then, of course, the celebration that grew out of that, that I guess went on for several years, but then sort of fell away, and then it's a reinstitution of recognition of Juneteenth Day. So it's really nice to, you know, to be able to share some history, and I think that's the important thing about this particular celebration, is to give people a perspective and share some history.
All right. Thank you, Jacqueline A. Kane. And I want to say that it's probably a lot more information that you got that you have to get out. And you may even transfer, you know, go into some other area and bring out information.
Right. Right?
That's key. We need this information.
Right.
So that's Jacqueline A. Kane. Thank you again.
Thank you, Willie.
All right. And she's got a book called A Real Whole Lot, A World War II Soldier Love Letters to His Wife.
Thank you, Willie.
You just heard a Juneteenth special of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. The content in today's program was produced by roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry with coverage and interviews from the 2019 Juneteenth celebration of the Capital Region in Central Park in Schenectady. For more Juneteenth stories, visit www.mediasanctuary.org. Thanks for tuning in.